Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Prisoners have made their mistakes in life, and most who have been caught are paying a high price for their wrongdoings. However, as I always try to relate to the public, prisoners should not be stereotyped, as the circumstances that led to their downfall are all different. We know the country's wealthiest, in most cases, are able to cover up the wrongdoings of their loved ones, yet are quick to condemn, target, abuse, deprive, and even prevent others, prisoners, from ever being released. Even in most cases, trying to portray first-time offenders as being more violent than they actually are. Some prisoners have stumbled as a result of being used, lied to, and deceived. As we all know, these things can happen. Others who may have needed some emotional support as they came from fatherless homes or abusive homes. Some physically, sexually, or even emotionally abused. Some wrongfully convicted. Whatever the case, prisoners can change. We're going to have on with us today a special guest. His name is Thomas Dormer. He is a 27-year-old former prisoner who is now attending school in California with the goal of becoming a professional soccer player. Thomas spent 4 years in prison from the age of 19 to 23 years. He is an avid animal lover, and he owns 4 dogs. Thomas is going to be on with us today to talk about the prison system as he knows it and the experiences he encountered while being behind those cold and careless bars. Thomas is another example of why prisoners should be given second chances in life, regardless of their offenses. So Thomas will be on with us in a few minutes, and these are some of the things that I just want the public to know, especially now with this international deadly virus that we have out there, the coronavirus. So many people are dying. It's becoming an epidemic worldwide. This is the time that everyone needs to look at prisoners in the same light they look at their neighbors, people out there in the communities, because they too are human beings. Many of them are in prison. They're in solitary confinement or on restrictive blocks where they don't have any access to a television or any kind of reading material. These are the prisoners that are going really very frustrated. They're going crazy because they don't know what their loved ones are going through on the outside. They don't know much about what's going on other than the fact that something very, very, very major is happening in the communities. And they don't know how to deal with it because they have no control over anything that's happening with them. We have to look at these prisoners also. There are many wrongfully convicted. There are many first-time offenders of any crime. There are so many prisoners who have been in for 20, 25, or even more years. So many who are over the age of 50 that have medical problems. With this virus going on, there has to be some compassion out there in the prisons, in the communities. Because if it was your loved one, we have to look at these things. It could be any one of your loved ones that are going through the same situations. And it could be through no fault of their own. Or it could be through some stumbling block that they came across. And I know that there are some pretty serious prisoners in prison, terrorists, serial killers, whatever the case may be. And I can understand having them in. But when you look at reducing the prison population with all these other prisoners, it frees them up to have single cells. It frees them up to have more opportunity to get the treatment that they need, whether it be psychological treatment, anger management treatment, whatever the treatment may be. So we have to look at all these things. Excuse me. Hold on a second. And that was Thomas calling in the wrong phone. He will be on with us in a few minutes. But again, as I said, these are some of the things that we need to look at right now in this crisis. And some may think this crisis will be over in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. But I think we're in it for the long haul. And I hope after these interviews that you will be listening to in the next coming weeks and today, that you will be able to have some compassion and understanding and help to get this message out to all the politicians, whatever state it may be in, wherever it may be. We need to get this out to the politicians to start looking at a lot of these prisoners and freeing them up, because either they have served enough time, they have served their time, they are suffering, they are old, they are medically ill, and many of them, like I say, wrongfully convicted, whatever the case may be. Many of them were victims before becoming offenders and have been victimized even more so since being incarcerated. So I hope that everyone will take this in heart and try to call the politicians. Call the prison, the commissioners in these Department of Corrections, and let them know prisoners have the right to know what's going on the outside in a case like this. So have them call and try to get some kind of phone, televisions, whatever they can get, so that they know what's going on in the outside. And now, once again, we have on with us Thomas Dormer. Again, Thomas is a former prisoner, a 27-year-old who is attending school in California now with the goal of becoming a professional soccer player. Thomas, again, spent 4 years in prison from the age of 19 to 23. He is an avid animal lover, and he is going to talk about the prison system and what he went through prior to and during and even now that he is out. So, Thomas, are you on with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, do you want to talk a little bit about yourself? I mean, I just said a few things, but maybe you want to talk some more about how you ended up in prison, how, you know, the things that were going on in your life at the time, some of the experiences you had while in prison, and how, when you came out, how you were able to start all over again. You have apparently achieved a lot of things.
Yeah, that's no problem. I can start from the beginning. When I was 18, I kind of had everything. I had potential scholarships for soccer, and I was a cadet firefighter already, almost paid on call, never got in trouble in my entire life. And then just a lot of things happened. You know, girl cheated on me, mother got cancer, and just a lot of things happened to me all at once. I couldn't really handle them as a grown man. And just a lot of weight on my shoulder. I lost my scholarships in a fight in a parking lot after a soccer match, which really wasn't, didn't really have anything to do with me. I was a captain of a team sticking up for my teammate. I always kind of did the right thing. And there went most of my scholarships. So I ended up doing a armed robbery with a fake gun with a couple guys that I knew at the time. Kind of just gave up on life, kind of just didn't really care, you know, but at the same time, I didn't have it in me to hurt anybody. So used a fake gun. When I was arrested, I was facing 130 years for 3 armed robberies at the time. And I bailed out it was a unique case because I bailed out for a property bond. And in the state of Wisconsin, they stopped doing property bonds in 2001 under the old law. So I was like the first case in the last, I think that was 11 years to get a property bond. My grandparents bailed me out. You know, they came in, they looked me in the eye, they said, you know, are you gonna be okay? You're gonna be the man we always knew you could be. And they put up their house for me. So my story really ended up, you know, started when I was on bail. I had to fight for my life. My first plea was 10 years in, 5 out. So kind of just the average for 3 armed robberies. And clearly I turned it down. And my whole community, thankfully, had my back. You know, a lot of churches wrote it. I volunteered over 1,000 hours. A lot of my neighbors wrote letters on my behalf. A lot of my school teachers, a lot of people that I touched up until this point. Definitely, you know, were advocates for me. So that went a long way. And, Then in December of 2012, I was sentenced to 4 years. My co-defendant was sentenced to 3 years, and then my other co-defendant was sentenced to 2 years. I took the main leadership for the armed robberies. I took the main brunt of it, the main, blame. I always owned up to my mistakes, and prison was a unique, very unique situation for me. At the time, I just turned 19. I was less than 30 days from 19. And, I was white. I was non-gang affiliated. I didn't know anybody in the prison system. And so that was definitely difficult getting used to it. I served all 4 years in the Wisconsin prison system. So I live in California now, and, I work with a lot of people that's been incarcerated out here. So, different states have different norms and everything like that, and how their prison system is run. So I can only speak about the one that I was at. And when I went in there, I kind of had a unique story of going in there as well, of what I accomplished. In the beginning of my prison bit, the first couple months, I got in a little trouble, hung out with the young gangbangers, the fast life. I was on the basketball court every day. I was basically just, getting into it every day with the young wild crew. And then, one day I got put in a cell with a big gang leader, for the whole prison of the, of a certain gang. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but it kind of changed my life. He was a lifer. Definitely changed my life from one day to the next. I started getting up early, started having to clean the cell every morning, at 5:36 in the morning, getting up for breakfast. He got me a job, and I just started bidding, and time was still, really rough for me in the beginning, first year. But right at 6 months, I was calling home every day. I was, still involved. I was still involved with my ex, and I was still involved, with my friends every day, trying to call them, wondering why they're not calling me, and why they're not, basically here. And I just started to go crazy in there. And, then, I met some people in there by now that were lifers, and they basically just told me to shut off the outside world and really worry about, my years that I had to do in there and get the best out of there. I didn't know you could go to a minimum security prison. I didn't know you could, do AA classes, anger management classes, anything like that, any programs or anything like that. So they opened up my eyes to just doing programs and kind of just, getting my bit going. So I started to do that. I eventually made it down to a minimum security prison after 2 years. And when I was in a minimum security prison in the state of Wisconsin, we have an opportunity to go into the workforce and, work some jobs where you get paid $7.25 an hour. It was really weird for me because in the beginning of working in prison, you make only like 13-14 cents. So I was able to prove enough that I was able to go into the workforce. And when I was able to go into the workforce, I got a job, and that's what kind of separated myself. When we first get a job, they tell you that you can't get a raise or that you can't move up into the company or anything really until you're released. And I worked at a third shift. Basically cleaned, it was like a meat packing company, and we basically cleaned the machines that ran meat for 16 hours prior to that. So, it smelled, blood was everywhere. It was kind of gross, but it was an opportunity, and I took it as an opportunity. And, everybody, when they go down to minimum, when they say that they're not going to break the rules, everybody breaks the rules. Everybody uses a cell phone, and everybody, gets away with a couple little things here and there. And, at the end of the day, most of these people are grown men that have families and, have life outside of bars. So, they just try to check in on their families and do things like this. And I didn't. I went to work every day. I put my head down and I just worked. And I ended up working two jobs there. And the company really, I really flourished in this company. So long story short, I ended up being the first inmate, you know, ever in the state of Wisconsin to get a raise at this company. I ended up becoming a lead. You know, there's a little complications becoming a lead because, you know, you got to ride a van ride to work with inmates and, you know, people from prison. And then you got to ride a van ride, you know, to home, you know, back to the prison with them. And, you know, when you're the boss of some guys, it can be a little difficult. So I ended up becoming a boss, being a lead at the sanitation company, and my department flourished. And basically, I ended up by that time knowing, you know, I was in, you know, prison 2.5 years. I ended up knowing a lot of people that was, you know, coming down to minimum that I was helping get down on minimum on contracts and on things like that. So I ended up getting a group of guys that I'd known for a long time and in my area. And we flourished. We worked every day. And they actually gave me another raise. I became a whole lead of the department while I was still incarcerated. And the prison really didn't know about this. The company didn't tell them, you know, the whole job that I was entitled because we couldn't be a head boss of a company, you know, that's making, you know, $80,000-$90,000 a year. While still being incarcerated and so basically running the whole crew, running the payroll, running the hours, running the holiday pay, everything that it entitles I was running, and they didn't really know about it. And that lasted for 4 months. I had a really, really good job, you know, a lot of income. Things were running really good. And then when the prison found out about it, they actually stuck me in segregation one day. They found out how much I was making. And they just stuck me in segregation. It was the first time I was ever in segregation. A little difficult, you know, a little difficult having my family see me like that and get sent back. But, you know, at the end of the day, when you're in the system, your word, you know, means nothing at the end of the day. So they had it was a fake ticket. You know, nothing about the ticket was true. But the captain came in there and said, if I don't sign the ticket, he's going to give me 90 days. In the hole, and he was going to make me wait 21 before even hearing my ticket. So I was going to be in the hole for 4 months and didn't really want to do that. He just said, listen, you know, I want you out of my minimum prison. You have too much power. We haven't seen anybody get this type of, you know, income you have or job. We just want you out of here. So they sent me back to medium security prison for the rest of my bid. And there I just met a lot of good guys too as well. You know, I was a workout king. You know, I always went and did the cardio classes, and I was always in the weight room for the 4 years. I was very blessed to have my biggest role models, you know, from Gary, Indiana, you know, from the Blackstone gang, from the Latin King gang, you know, from these gangs and the Bloods. You know, these gangs really, really put their arms around me. And thankfully, I knew a lot of, you know, big influences that, you know, kind of carried me throughout the whole prison. And I'm still very blessed to meet all of these individuals because I could have had a way different outcome. So basically that's what happened. And I have a million stories in between that, what I've seen, you know, what I saw. You know, I've seen a couple people die. I've seen, you know, a lot of different altercations, a lot of, you know, stressful times. But, you know, Even when I was incarcerated, the last thing that really sticks with me was, you know, my first Christmas. After a year, I didn't know if I could continue to do prison. It was super difficult on me, even though it was only a year. But I didn't know if I could continue to do it, and I was really contemplating committing suicide in there. And, you know, when you commit suicide in prison, when you attempt it, you know, you better go through it, because if you attempt and fail, it's a very rough time for you. You know, the measures that they have to take and the suicide watch and all that other thing. So I don't want to deal with that. And on Christmas of 2013, I was, you know, in my cell all day. I made a phone call. The phone call didn't go good. And I was just like, you know, thinking like, could I really do this another 3 years? You know, now it seems, you know, little, but at the time I was like, I don't know if I could continue getting up. I looked out my cell. I seen all the negativity, all of the, you know, stress and just negativity everywhere. And I was like, I don't know if I can continue getting up every day and doing this. And my best friend at the time, He ran it for La Familia gang, who was like one of the youngest gang member leaders, you know, in this prison. And he knocked on my door at like midnight. We were able to stay up until 1 a.m. on Christmas. And I was in my cell all day. I didn't leave 1 minute. It was very uncommon for that at this point. And he just knocked on my cell, and he was like, come out and play cards. You know, I had three best friends on this unit. They're all waiting on me to play cards. They can't play without me. And I was like, no, I don't want to play cards. And they were like, listen, man, you've been here all day. You're not going to ruin my Christmas. They're like, you know, just come out here for a little bit, you know, 30, 40 minutes, and then, you know, you can go back in your cell. So he convinced me. So I went out there. I sat down playing cards. He started dealing them out. And within the first hand, next thing you know, he threw all the cards on the ground. And he was like, you know, fuck that. Excuse my language. But he was like, you know, screw that. And he was like, let's go outside. So it's Christmas 2013 in Wisconsin. It's about 5 degrees outside. It's freezing cold, snow on the ground. And I'm like, why are we going to go outside? And, you know, we could go outside on this little section, little couple-foot section. And we went outside, and him and my two other friends, you know, kind of pushed me up against the wall. And I didn't quite know what was going on at the time. And I was like, you know, what's going on? And right away, he was like, you're thinking about killing yourself, aren't you? And I kind of looked at him crazy because I wasn't expecting him to say that. And I was like, you know, what do you mean? And he's like, you're thinking about killing yourself right now. And he just set a date. Now, you know, I can't remember what exactly date he said, but he just set a date. And I looked at him, and he was like, you know, that was the day I was thinking about killing myself. And then my two other best friends, they set a date as well. And these guys right now, at the time I was 20, and Ray Ray was his name, ran it for La Familia. He was 24. We had Los, he was a big king. He was 28. And then we had Fresno, he was a blood, a weird group. And he had, he was 26. And they were all down. Ray Ray at the time was down 8 years since he was 16. Fresno was down 9 years since he was like 17. And Los was down 10 years since he was 18. So all these guys, you know, were still kind of young, but they've all served basically their whole life, adult life in prison. And they all just kind of looked at me, and they're like, listen, this shit is hard. You know, this shit, you know, there's many times I've thought about giving up. And they just gave me the speech, like, you know, we were in your shoes, but at the end of the day, you know, you got to feel grateful for having 4 years. You got to feel grateful for having visits and, you know, hope, man. They're like, you know, we don't really see anybody like you. You know, you're going to make it, man. And they just gave me hope. And every day I got up at 5:30 the next morning. For the next 3 years, even when I was in segregation, I didn't miss. I didn't spend a holiday off. I didn't spend a birthday off. Didn't celebrate my birthday for the next 3 years. I just bit it. I just got up every single day, 5:30. We did the same workouts. We were in the rec every day. And we just started talking about, you know, when we were getting out and plans and what's our goals and working towards them. So that day really changed my life, you know, because I was the first one to get out. In my group of people, my group, my circle that I surrounded myself, I was the first one to really get out. So, sorry, I think you can hear the dogs. I have 5 dogs.
Oh, that's okay. I wanted to, just for a minute, I want to interrupt you for a minute. And also, Thomas, I'd like to have you back on again. We could do it tomorrow morning as well, because we started off wrong this morning. I had given you a 10 o'clock time to call in, and I again, forget that you're on the Western Coast. I'm on the East. So things got a little confusing this morning. But you mentioned in the beginning that you had goals to go and to become a professional soccer player. And you seem like it's not often either that young people have these kind of goals. And I know of a young man who went through exactly what you went through. And they too, they went to Bridgeton Academy. They wanted to be, he wanted to be a professional football player. Messed up his knee though. But the same thing. And relationships, sometimes people tend to think that men are always the ones that are deceptive and lying to the women, but it does happen both ways. And I just want the audience to know this, because in his case, he went away to he was in college 4 years. And while he was in college, in this situation, it was biracial and it was white, Caucasian and biracial. There were issues with the family, but the relationship was off. It was one-sided because most of the time was being spent at his dorm, which caused him in his last year of college to fall behind by one subject, not able to graduate. And the fact was, opening up to her about things that happened to him as a child and things that everything came simultaneously came down. And again, he committed an offense. The thing is, you are fortunate in one way because the prisons are full of prisoners who had goals like you and like this young man. The prisons are full of young men and women who have so many goals in their life. They want to be somebody. They want to do something. And they can get into a relationship that's very deceptive, very toxic, where they can have their downfalls. With you, it was an armed robbery, maybe, with a plastic gun or a play gun. With others, it could be a real gun. And this is the difference. Prisoners are stereotyped, and there are prisoners inside who are pretty bad, and there are prisoners who could care less if they ever get out because they don't have that support out there. Many don't have parents, or they don't have a father or a mother, or they come from a drug-infested home or abusive home. But the thing is, to be able to try to do what you do, and this prisoner, the same thing, wanted to take higher educational correspondence courses, did get a job working in culinary arts, was getting along good with the instructor until the officials went over the instructor's head to have this young man fired. There's so many. You mentioned how you got a job, and because you were getting paid much more than most people would be, regardless of what you were getting paid, you were doing something positive. And the officials in these prison officials, they should know, as long as a prisoner is trying, regardless of what they're getting paid, regardless of what it is that they're doing, as long as they're being productive while incarcerated, that's the main thing. Those who are violent, those who are dangerous, those are the ones it seems like the guards and the officials are afraid to mess with. So they pretty much take it out on the meek or the mild or the most least problematic rather than the most. But in your case, you've come a long way, and I just have to say that because you remind me so much of other prisoners that I have come across and that I actually know in person that has tried so hard to do the right things. And sometimes it's the ones they think are the most violent. In some of these cases, gang members, there are so many gang members that are inside who are decent people. They just got in with other people that were going through the same thing they were going through. And if people in the communities were more supportive and more helpful and try to understand what these young men and women go through, maybe they wouldn't be turning to others that are going through the same thing, others that are full of frustration and anger. And this is what it is with the gang members. I believe a lot of gangs were formed because of young men and women who were just frustrated with the way the system was, the communities were, the people out there that are so righteous that judge without even knowing what they're going through. Mm-hmm. But I had to say that, and you can go on with what you were saying.
Yeah, just, you know, I totally agree. You know, I've always had altercations with the COs, and, you know, thankfully I was super blessed to have a support system. And because by the time I almost got released, at that point, the COs really didn't mess with me the last couple months, but when I got out of segregation, I didn't mess with the COs at all. You know, I carried myself the same every day. I never switched up. You know, I would never say good morning or anything. You know, if a CO at any unit I went on, if a CO always said like good morning or how are you doing, I always had the same conversation with them. You know, I don't want to be spoken to unless, you know, I'm in trouble. You know, because at the end of the day, you don't really care how I'm doing. You know, I could be thrown in segregation and it's, you know, you're still going to go about your day. So I just want to, you know, my job is to not make your job harder. And that's all I want to do. And I don't want to have any contact with you. So, like I said, I have five dogs. So now since I moved to LA, so I adopted two fighting dogs. So they've been very difficult a year ago, but, yeah, so, you know, I got
out. You had also mentioned your suicide attempts, and I will say this. Prisoners have attempted suicide as well. And sometimes all they want is a single cell and to be able to do what they need to do, just sometimes they just want to be by themselves to try to figure out, you know, what happened, how am I going to go from here? Like you said, it was all new to you. And for a first-time offender, I can understand where you're coming from. Where some prisoners, they have never been in trouble with the law before. They have never been involved with drugs or alcohol. You know, they were college-oriented. They just wanted to be somebody in life. And these are the ones that fail. They've tried to commit suicide. And what's happened in some cases, when they didn't succeed in what they were trying to do, they would get beaten up by the guards for trying to commit suicide. You know, prisoners have been abused by the guards because they haven't wanted to share a cell. But sometimes prisoners cannot deal with sharing cells when they're going through all kinds of other things. And sometimes it's okay to, when they're in for short term, like yourself. And I don't know if you had your own single cell or you double celled, but you made your friends within. And sometimes prisoners support one another. And this is where they really find out the truth of a prisoner, because not all of them are bad. Yes. They have to act bad sometimes because of the environment they're in.
Yes. I totally agree with that. I always say, you know, you play the hand that's dealt to you. Because like I said, you know, there's certain things in prison that, you know, I got in trouble in. And, you know, people from the outside that even supported me couldn't understand it. And I'm like, you know, it's not like you wake up one day and you want to go to segregation. But you wake up one day and that's what's forced to you. You know, somebody does something and in there, it's a different world. There's so many things that don't even compare to the real world. No mannerisms, no anything. And for one, I didn't have a single cell until I was down to minimum for a while. But I'm blessed that I didn't have a single cell in the beginning, you know, because I didn't really know how to bid. I didn't really know about the scheduling and getting on all that. So I was blessed, but the thing that was difficult was when I was in segregation, they put me in a cell with somebody, and that's actually against the law in my state. You know, I've Googled it. I've looked up since I've been out. You're not supposed to put two people in segregation in the same cell, and we used to have 40, 50 cells open, and they put me in a room with another guy. And in segregation, you know, at least in my state, that's really where all the sexual, I guess, batteries and offenses really happen when you're in segregation, because they don't really check up on you. They just, you know, put your meal through their door. You're able to use a phone once a week, and they do their rounds at, you know, way less than normal. And that's really where I seen a lot of, and that was at the end of my bid, a lot of, you know, some things like that in these cells and hearing, you know, crazy things at nighttime. And like I said, you know, there's not much more of a stressful time than being in a cell. And some, first of all, somebody's got to sleep on the floor. Somebody's got to sleep on the little slab of concrete. So right away, you know, you have to, I had to announce myself as I'm not sleeping on the floor. So, you know, you got to walk in a cell and, you know, it's a very stressful environment. You got to look at another human being and basically, you know, that's just prison. You know, that's not real life. That's not anything. That's prison. It's who's more dominant. And, you know, the more dominant man is going to succeed in that situation. So that was a really rough time for me at the end. But thankfully, I had over 3 years under my belt. I kind of had a reputation at that time. Everybody kind of knew who I was. So hey, I didn't really care. You know, it was prison was one thing. You have to, like you said, you have to act a certain way. And I was just blessed. I was blessed to have a team around me, you know, from the minute I touched down. You know, I had most of my individual friends were black, and they were mostly black guys that hated white people, that hated them, that were brought up by, you know, hating them and thinking that, you know, the only white people are cops and, you know, they've never really had a white friend. You know, they're from the projects of Chicago. They're from Gary, Indiana. You know, I'm from the Midwest, so they're all from these areas where, you know, white people don't even exist, you know, living there. So I was just blessed to be put in a couple of their paths, and I ended up, like I said, becoming best friends with, you know, the leader of the Blackstones at the time for the state of Wisconsin, and he kind of paved the path. And then, you know, I got put in a cell with the leader of the Latin Kings from, you know, from all these different backgrounds. I started, you know, reaching, and I told them my goals, and I knew right away, you know, prison hit me hard. I was college bound. My whole life I was very dedicated as far as being an athlete, as far as keeping my head on straight. You know, I knew what to do, and I since I was in first grade, you know, you had to put down what do you want to be in life. I always put down, I want to play college soccer, and then I want to go pro. But I always wanted to play college soccer. That was my only goal in life. And, you know, I've had teachers always say, you know, have a plan B, have a plan B. And I never did. I never had a plan B for 18 years of my entire life. It was college soccer. I had honor roll my senior year. And like I said, I never had cuffs on me in my entire life. And, you know, when I didn't get my soccer scholarship, it kind of, my life started to, like, kind of shake and crumble down on me. And then instantly, like, within all weeks, like 2-3 weeks, you know, I didn't get my soccer scholarship I was hoping for. I had a fiance at the time. She cheated on me. My best friends, you know, since eighth grade, same group. And, they all did me wrong. And I was basically by myself, and I'm firefighting, and I just got so mad at the world, I just quit firefighting one day. It was a really bad decision. And by the time I graduated, I was this real popular guy. Everybody in my city knew me, and I had so much potential, and it amounted to nothing. So it hit me hard. I felt worthless, and then 2 weeks later, I was in jail facing 130 years in prison, and I even felt more worthless, and then I had to fight for my life. You know, I bailed out. I was all over the TV. I was all over the news. Everybody knew what I did. Everybody knew I was out on bail. I was trailed by the cops for a year. I was out on bail for a year. I couldn't go to the grocery store. I couldn't go anywhere without the police getting behind me, waiting until I left my car, and basically telling me that they told me many times, like, you're going to prison soon, and, you know, we're just making sure you're being safe. So I was harassed the entire time. But like I said, I volunteered over 1,000 hours. I public spoke at my churches, and I got involved in a program called the 180 Juvenile Diversion Program. It's for teenage kids, you know, from 17 to 24 that get into minor trouble. You kind of pay this fee, and it's kind of like a boot camp. Well, I became a public speaker there, you know, basically speaking when I was out on bail about how much opportunity I had in life. And now instead, I'm facing 130 years in prison, and I don't know how many I will get, you know, the whole time.
You know, this is sad, because this is exactly what you're saying is true. They will harass not only you, they'll harass family members, they'll harass your friends,
oh, yeah,
to the point where they don't,
yep,
your friends and your family will back away. They don't want to deal with it because they're being harassed,
yep,
so much.
Yep.
All the good that you did, I'm sure, even if it was on the internet, I'm sure it was taken off, because what they try to do is they try to portray you in the worst possible way. Even though you have an excellent background, the professors at the school will vouch for you. This is what the professors did with this other young man. They vouched. They said that he had such a good reputation, like yourself. But when something like that happens, all of a sudden, even the people that admired you so much, had so much respect for you, all of a sudden they change. But then again, you have to blame the media as well, because the media,
yes,
will report one-sided stories, and there's always two or three sides to a story. So, but the thing is, your goal has not been forgotten. It's just delayed. My question to you is, soccer players, what is the maximum age limit that they are allowed to play soccer?
They can play until they're in their mid-30s. So my time is whittling down to be a pro athlete. But like I said, I'm going to have one shot at the end of this year, you know, early next year, and I'm going to give it everything. I still believe in myself, but I've had a lot of you know, bad things to happen in my life, you know, including the 4 years of prison, plus the year of bail was key, because that's a whole nother year I didn't play. So I didn't play soccer for 5 years. I kept my dream, and I actually tore my ACL in prison, and they didn't fix it. You know, I had a torn ACL my last year, and they told me that I didn't have enough time to get it fixed. So they let me walk the yard. They let me work out. They let me do everything with a torn ACL. So that was a big, big mile marker over me, and I was still able to rehab the muscles around it, so I was still able to run and play. And when I got out, I had one shot at a semi-pro team right away, and I was working out to try to get back on it, and my whole knee gave out. I tore my ACL, my MCL, my meniscus.
The other one's the same thing, and now he has a torn rotator cuff in his shoulder, but he had the same thing with his knee. you want to, Thomas, you want to give the audience your contact information in the event that they want to help in any way, or if someone wanted to help or get in contact with you. Do you have a website, an email, or some way that they can contact you?
I have an email. I have an email. I have social media accounts, and I have my phone number. Either way, you know, whatever one you want me to rattle off.
Whatever one you want to give out, just so that they can have contact with you. And this usually goes on the Internet, the interview. It'll also go out throughout Facebook, so everyone will get a chance to see this. And again, as they say,
yeah,
I'd like to have you back on tomorrow, if possible. If not, another day.
No, I can be back on tomorrow, and I'll give out my email. My email is T period Dormer, D-O-R-M-E-R. It's just my name, T Dormer 89 at yahoo.com. That is my email, and then my phone number is 414-336-2535.
Okay. Now, the school that you're going to, is that a is that a school for athletics events, or is it,
it
just an academic?
No, it does have athletics. It's a JUCO, and I actually tried out last team for the team, and I made captain of the team. And we had a really good year. So, you know, things are looking good.
This is a success story, and I'm really thankful that we had this opportunity, this honor to have you on, because what you're talking about is the perfect example of a person that's so productive, so has so many goals in life, that has been not destructed completely, but distracted for a temporary period of time, and your goal is still there. You're still focused on that one goal of becoming a professional soccer player, which is an awesome thing too. You've had your barriers. Now, what about your parents? Are your parents involved? Are they still living?
Yes, both my parents are still involved. They're still married. We've had some rough patches, but you know, my parents and I have never really. I haven't really got along. I have two older brothers and a younger sister. I'm out in California with my younger sister. It's just me and her. I don't really talk to my brothers that much. And my mom and dad, we're rebuilding it because, you know, I came from a very dysfunctional family, even though they were married. And, you know, from the outside looking in, everything seemed fine. But it was a pretty messed up house coming home to every day. So, you know, and they finally realized the older they got, you know, how much it weighed on me. So, but I can say one thing. My mom visited me every single week for 4 years straight. She never missed her visit, and she cried every time she left, you know, even in segregation, even in everything. You know, we didn't have always good visits, but it was difficult, you know, for my family. Like I said, I had correctional officers tell me that worked 30 years, that I've had almost every correctional officer in every facility I ever went to tell me that I was the only one that they ever seen in 3 visits a week, with phone calls every single day. They've never seen the amount of support, the amount of letters. Every single day I got letters from my community. My public spoke my story while I was still incarcerated with that program through the courthouse. Actually, I was actually working with the courthouse while I was in prison, telling the real live story about Beyond the Bars. So, you know, I was blessed with their support. I needed it sometimes, you know. But like I said, you know, it's been we've had to rebuild our relationship because, you know, clearly when, you know, you go to prison, you know, I never talked to my parents about what was going on or anything. So, you know, we've worked a lot of time to rebuild that, and I've worked a lot of time to rebuild all the other relationships. But at the end of the day, I've been out 4 years, and you know, I trust myself, and, you know, I trust the plan, and if I'm able to do what I want to do, then I'll be the first one actually ever to do what I do, coming from my background.
I believe you will.
So nobody's
ever done
it.
I really believe you will. You seem to have a real head on your shoulder. You seem to be very intelligent. And you mentioned dysfunctional families. I will say I did social work for many, many years, and working with families and children, adolescents, even geriatric, pediatric, all of them. But I will say one thing. We live in a very dysfunctional country, and I can't say there is any family that doesn't have some kind of dysfunction in it. It really. And there's so many that are so insecure. You get a lot of these people that are so insecure that they're afraid to do anything on their own. They have to they have to be accepted by their peers, whether they be in politics or whether they be in the communities, families or whatever. And the only way a person's going to be happy is, like yourself, is to have your own goals and not let anything or anyone stop it. You said you've been thinking about becoming a professional soccer player since a childhood, and you have not let that leave your mind since. And you're going to succeed. You may not have much time in it once you get there, but at least you're going to reach your goals.
Yeah, that's fine. My, you know, my purpose of life, I always, you know, put it down, and selfishly I wanted to play soccer. I wanted to get married at a young age. I wanted to do all this. I was headstrong on my whole future and going to college. So, like I said, it really hit me hard when I was wearing state clothes, sitting in a cell. I could barely see my mirror and being in prison. It took me, like I said, a long time, a year, to really understand, you know, how much of a bum I was at the time, and how much, you know, basically my dream, I went the total opposite way. So it hit me hard. But at this point, I've seen a lot of results now, and my life goals are still the same. I think I can still use my level that I get to, my platform, to help out everybody. I want people from my background to have a chance. And like I said, I never talked to one person that ever was even in jail, let alone prison, my whole life until now. And you realize that it's not just a 4-year sentence. You know, this is a life sentence. You know, I'm a second class citizen, you know, for the rest of my life. Basically, I found out even these 4 years, you know, I've applied for over 100 jobs. I've been, you know, my resume is better than most people. It's taken me a long time to get a job. It's taken me a long time to get back into school. It's taken me, you know, a long time to get all of these things. And at the end of the day,
if
I can only
speak. I don't know if they've succeeded or not yet. But, I mean, if they started it yet. But they were going to be doing away after, I think it's after 5 years, doing away with the quarry. So you don't have to worry about, you know, your name showing up every time you apply for a job. That was one of the biggest issues that they've spoken of throughout these, you know, last 10, 15 years.
That's what prevents a lot of young men
and women when they come out from getting jobs, is that they have that quarry that's keeping them from getting any jobs.
Yeah, that's something I still speak about on my system, because at the end of the day, I feel like everybody that goes to prison definitely has it rough. Don't get me wrong. I'm not taking everybody that goes to prison, you know, their side. Trust me, I met a lot of bad people that deserve to be in there, and a lot of bad people that, you know, you can see why they can't make it in society, you know, totally.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, in my state of Wisconsin, nobody's ever made it. You know, when I came out to California, there's people that I've met now in college that are professors, that have degrees, that are lawyers now, that own their own businesses, that are actors, that are somebody out here where they're given a little chance. But coming from a sheltered place like Wisconsin, which is, you know, not diverse at all, you know, all of the blacks and Hispanics are in certain areas, you know, there's not a lot of diversity. That's not true, because, you know, even though after 5 years, you know, if you don't have a certain crime, I think if you have certain crimes, you always have to tell them. But if you have certain crimes like I do, I'm a first-time offender, and it's my crime is actually 8 years old. I don't have to put it down on job resumes or anything, but the state of Wisconsin has something called CCAP, and we're the only state that has this. We're one of the only states in the United States that have this, and as well as truth and sentencing. And if you read up on truth and sentencing, it's one of the toughest punishments in the United States as far as crime. We don't have any good time. We don't have any programs in our prison. We don't have anything to get out early. Where in California, Illinois, New York, all these other places, you know, you have good time. You have incentives to act right in prison, where in Wisconsin, you don't. You have no good time. It's truth and sentencing. I think we're the one of three states that only has truth or sentencing, as well as CCAP. CCAP is when you come out, basically any employer or anything can look your record up. And I logged all these when I got out, because I truly 100% believe I will be somebody successful in this world where I can help out many people from my background. And I logged over 50 jobs that I applied for, 50 when I got out in my small town, and I couldn't get a job. And every person put, every employer put that, oh, it wasn't because of my record, because they legally couldn't tell me that. But CCAP is a free thing where you just type in CCAP on Google. And in the state of Wisconsin, if they have your government name, which you apply for a job, so they do have it, all they do is have to put it in this thing. And anything that you've ever been arrested for, from misdemeanor to anything, pops up on there. It's a famous thing. Everybody in Wisconsin uses it. Every girl uses it before they meet a man. Every employer uses it before they hire somebody, so they don't have to say, oh, it's not because of this. California doesn't have that. And when I came out to California, I finally, for the first time in my life, put I didn't have a felony, and all of a sudden I started just getting jobs. I was able to kind of choose for my job, so it was a way different. You know, I worked at a car wash for $9 an hour for 2 years. That was the only job I could get in my state. You know, I have a 2017 Dodge Challenger Hemi that's yellow, so I have a $45,000 car, brand new, that I bought. But that took me 2 years working at a car wash. So, and imagine, you know, driving that car around my city, you know, what everybody thought that I really did to get that car, when really I just sat in my parents' basement for 2 full years when I got out, and I worked 60 hours a week, and that's all I did. I trained 3 dogs, and I came home, never went to a bar one time. So it's different, you know, and that's just what I keep advocating, you know, because some people get offended in California because I'm so grateful for the system, how it's set up here. Don't get me wrong, there's still many flaws I see, and there's still many barriers. But at the end of the day, if you really have a right head on your shoulders and you have a right mentality and you have the right plan, it's difficult, but you at least have an opportunity in California. I truly believe that you're at least given a small opportunity. It's small, and there's a lot of barriers to come with it. There's a lot of strings attached to it that they don't like to say, but it's there. And that's the only thing I'm advocating for. It's not there in my state. You know, it's not there.
California is a huge, huge state, though. I was good, very good friends with a girl. Her last name was Toomey from Wisconsin. I went to a Mayan Indian school, and Martha used to go back and forth. But Wisconsin is totally different than California. And California, there's all kinds of opportunities. All kinds.
So,
but you know what I was going to say? A lot of people don't realize this, but and you'd be perfect for this. They have... You can start your own nonprofit when you come out. You can start your own nonprofit. You could start a nonprofit to teach young people soccer. You know, to do all these things, to be your own boss. You could do these things. You could get a tape recorder, talk into that tape recorder all the time about your whole life history. It doesn't have to be in chronological order or anything, but get it in a tape recorder and then decide to write a book about your life, because you have very interesting life, and there's so much that you can share through a book. These are some of the things that you can do on your own without even having to be employed by anyone else. Because, again, this country we live in, every state has the same problems. Everything is the same. Regardless of what it may be, every state is different. But it's not different when it comes to the policies, the regulations. This country is so inconsistent. Every state is different in the way they operate, but the problems in every state are just the same. And this country needs to get it more together, more in line with one another for these states, because this is not a continent with a continent of different countries like Africa. This is the United States of America. It's one continent. And it's one country, and all these states should be operating the same way. And maybe there wouldn't be so much dysfunction in this country. But again, with your past, with everything that you have talked about on the show today, you could write your own book, you could start your own nonprofit, and you would have so much to offer young people that even around the age that you were when you first went in, and you were just... Basically, you were like a child, an adolescent. You were in your youthful days. Everybody makes mistakes. Not one of us can say that we've never made a mistake, that we cannot take back. That's the sad thing about it. We cannot take back the errors that we've made. And politicians make them all the time. There was a politician right from Vermont, and I mentioned this before, who he struck a reporter during a time when he was out in the community. And the reporter fell. That reporter could have fell. He could have hit his head. He could have died. The next day, that politician said he made a mistake. He was sorry. It was something he couldn't take back. There are so many first-time offenders who have made a mistake that they cannot take back. But they don't look at that person. They look at their own situation, and they forget or they don't care about the other person's situation. But
yes,
again,
I would say
start a nonprofit, and you would get so many. You could start. What I did, I started a nonprofit, and I never in 2004, and I never asked for funding. But what I did, I registered the organization with numerous universities and colleges across the country, and I was getting students that were going to school for law, paralegal, psychology, social work. These were all people that wanted to work on prison issues. They wanted to get the experience. Some of them wanted to do their internship. These were all volunteers. You could do the same thing. You could apply for funding for your organization, for your administrative and stipends for your volunteers, whatever the case may be. You would get it. Thomas, you would definitely get it, and you should consider that.
I have considered a lot of things. One of the things that drive me is when I was in prison, I remember asking this question. I was on the yard one day with all the influential people out there. There was something going on. It was right when the George Zimmerman trial. I'll never forget it. It changed the prison culture as far as in my state. You know, a lot of riots and a lot of, you know, fighting and racial tensions happened when George Zimmerman was found not guilty. And I remember asking them, you know, who's ever made it from prison here? You know, like, is there one famous, because I've never looked into it. I was like, you know, is there one guy everybody looks up to? Or is like, is there somebody that walked in these shoes that made it? And in my state, there's nobody. I've never talked to a single individual, a single human being that has ever said, yeah, there's somebody that went to prison first. You know, we have people around the world that, you know, around the United States, you know, from California, you know, Danny Trevejo and actors, you know, you got Meek Mill in Philly, and you got certain things like this with people now for the first time really speaking up about the prison system and trying to change it. But I've always been focused on my state, and in the state of Wisconsin, it's a death sentence. And I've said it since the very beginning, you know, I didn't make a mistake, though. I made a choice. I made a wrong choice, and I've always owned up to that choice. You know, from the minute I made that wrong choice, I've looked everybody in the eye. Every bit of my paperwork says that I've owned up to it. I took blame. I served the most time out of my co-defendants. I stood tall. And when I served the most time, I turned down a one-year plea. You know, the DA offered me 10 years in 5 out. When I first got arrested, and after bail, after public speaking on my city, after getting hundreds and hundreds of letters, even the judge said she's never seen a case like mine. But I took the blade, and I turned down going into prison 1 year to do four, and I've never hesitated ever since that. I've always owned up to my poor choices, and from the very minute I've owned up to them, I've consistently done everything I said I would do in life, and I truly think prison is going to make me be the person that I want to be. You know, even though I had to go that route, trust me, out of all people, I wish I could have went back in time a million times. But, you know, it gets to a certain day where you learn to accept it, you learn to live with it, and you learn to deal with it. And, you know, it's not about them low moments. It's about what you do in them low moments. And, you know, from the minute I've had my low moments, I told everybody in prison, I used to give people hope. I used to run, you know, workout groups in prison. I used to be the motivational speaker, and I would be this, you know, little white boy running around giving everybody hope, saying, you know, listen, like, the one good thing about prison is if you can thrive in a situation like this, just imagine being
Well, you
free
know what? Sometimes God has a purpose for these things, too. And if you have helped a lot of prisoners, then that means that there was a purpose for it. Now, Thomas, we're going to be closing down in about 25 seconds. Tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock your time, and I'm so sorry. 9 o'clock your time, 12 o'clock my time, okay?
Yes,
and we're going to have people calling in tomorrow, too. So this will go out after we're finished, and then tomorrow we'll set it up so that people can actually call in and ask questions as well.
Okay, I appreciate it. I will see you
so much. I really, really feel honored that you're on with us today. You have a story to tell, and it was a beautiful, beautiful story.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.